I'm very sorry Professor Carpenter isn't here because they concern his world very closely. I just put, a few minutes ago, I was talking to a member of this class who is translating Understanding Media into Greek. And the first question, I'd only met him a few minutes ago, and the first question I asked him, what is the Greek word for environment? I just wrote it on the board. You probably can't see it. It's peri, P-E-R-I-V-A-L-L-O, perivalo. And I said, well, what does that literally mean? It means to strike, he said, to hit. Valo is the Greek for hitting or striking. Now, that is exactly the meaning of environment in my Understanding Media. An environment is that which is made by us and which hits us. The Greek literal meaning of the Greek for environment is that which hits you from all sides at once, peri. The moment a child is born into this world, he is hit right on the nose by his environment. And you go on being hit right on the nose by your environment. Only the environments that we make are far more potent than the ones that just happen to be around before man became so inventive. So, every time you extend any portion of your body into the environment, like your feet as wheel, that creates a road system that is a new environment that hits you. Paper, parchment, for example, does not permit you to have roads. Paper does. Countries that only have parchment cannot have a road system. Why? There's not enough parchment to permit people to carry messages all over the place. And so they get along without roads. When you have paper, you can have roads because you need hundreds of people traveling back and forth with messages to distant places. The Romans had paper, the Greeks did not. The Greeks never had roads. The Romans had paper routes based on papyrus. When the papyrus supplies dried up, Egypt finally rebelled and said, no more papyrus for those Roman SOBs. And the Roman Empire collapsed. Their road system collapsed. Their armies collapsed. Anybody down there want to make a little talk?
No, I was impressed that papyrus was more like parchment.
No, parchment is made from skins and is very scarce. And papyrus is made from vegetables. Reeds. The Chinese paper came in the 11th century and opened up the road system again. The old Roman roads opened up again when Chinese paper came back to Europe in the 11th century. That was called the Renaissance. When paper became cheap again, handmade paper, it became possible to open up the road system again, and we call it the Renaissance. There never would have been any Gutenberg, there never would have been any revival of the classics, there never would have been any Renaissance without Chinese paper. Creates an environment that really hits you. That help you? You won't read this in any book except Understanding Media. On us you will. Bias Communication. Harold Innes has something on paper and paper routes. Yes, sir?
What was the effect of Chinese?
They didn't have an alphabet. They could not write messages You see, until the alphabet came in, writing never had the meaning that it has for the Western world. Chinese and Japanese writing and all other forms of writing create only little pockets of culture. They do not create visual space. They do not create interconnected spaces. They create little pockets of village-like cultures such as we are returning to now in the Electric Age. Hippie style. Chinese writing does not create visual space, does not create civilization, does not create roads. Now, you haven't read Understanding Media, or you wouldn't have said that nonsense.
You didn't say yes.
Because I explain this in detail. There's only one kind of writing that creates civilization. Hebrew writing does not. Arabic writing does not. Persian writing does not. Chinese, Japanese writing do not create civilization because they do not create visual space. There is only one kind of writing that creates visual space, and that's phonetic writing. And it is invented 2,500 years ago by the Greeks, and they invented civilization at the same time they invented the phonetic alphabet and Euclidean geometry. We no longer live in an age of phonetic alphabet or of Euclidean geometry. Visual space is finished.
May I speak on that? There's a rather interesting thing in relation to this. In 1400 B.C., on the island of Knossos, there was invented the first phonetic alphabet. It was very primitive, but nevertheless, it did have phonetic symbols in it. Now, Knossos is very close to Egypt. At the same time in Egypt, there was reigning a pharaoh named Akhenaten, and he was the first pharaoh in Egypt to sponsor illustrative painting. You know? And I found this at the time extremely interesting because I wanted to find, being convinced that there is a definite parallel between the development of phonetic writing and verisimilitude or visual reality in paintings. As soon as I encountered these things, either one or the other, I want to find its counterpart. A similar incident happened when I discovered that 11th century Japanese sculpture was highly realistic. And I checked that through with Japanese scholars and discovered that in the 11th century, for a very brief time, the Japanese had a phonetic alphabet. This is apropos what will happen in a few minutes, actually, with our slides.
Well, I think we'd better put on the first slide. Try to illustrate is the kinds of space which pre-literate people live in. We are post-literate, but you could get a better idea of your condition if you look at the pre-literate.
Yeah, one of the things I would like you to notice about this, actually, is the quality of profile.
This is a cave painting.
Yeah, it's about approximately 17,000 B.C. Archaeologists are not too sure of this. The dates range from about 11,000 to 30,000 B.C. But the most salient thing I think about it is this tremendous stress on the profile, the frontal parallel quality of the image. It lies flat on the plane.
But it does not lie flat on the wall. One of the things that photography, one of the bad things photography did for cave painting was to make people think that cave paintings were painted on flat surfaces. In practice, in the first place, they were never intended to be seen by anybody. They were never intended to be looked at. They were painted in very dark and secret places, on very rough surfaces, with one painting after another painted on top of the other, dozens deep. Many of the paintings are hidden underneath rock shelves and ledges of rock, way out of sight. But when the cameras came along, they created the illusion that these cave paintings were something that you might have seen in the Metropolitan Museum, flat on a wall. They never were flat on anything. And they were never intended to be looked at. Why? That's magic. You painted these objects entirely, less like sticking pins in a wax voodoo object.
Just as today, as a matter of fact, the process was the important thing and not the product. It was the act of doing it that wherein lay the magic. Parallel to what Dr. McLuhan is saying, there's another very interesting example of the effect of assumptions upon these paintings. L'Abbé Bruil, at the end of the 19th century, was the great scholar in this area, and he went out and made drawings of them, complete with 19th century modeling and chiaroscuro, and because he thought he could see them there, because this is what he expected to see in any depiction on a surface. So that all the Abbé Bruil's renderings make them look like illustrations, and they are definitely not that.
He tried to give them some degree of realism, as if this was really a picture of some sort of an animal or a buffalo.
He exists in no space, incidentally. There's no attempt to render, to put him into any kind of a visual space.
He has no background, no surroundings, no environment. No setting, and no perspective, no point of view possible. In looking at one of these objects, I'm going to read you a poem, just a few line poem, written by Eskimos, translated by Professor Carpenter, who, I'm very sorry that he's not here to read his own poem to you, but Professor Parker and myself have done a book on space in poetry and painting. This is one of our first painting exhibits, and I'll read you now one of the first poems which appear in the book. We don't have the slide for it at the moment, but I'll just read it to you. Great sea, great sea, S-E-A, great sea, send me drifting, moves me, weed in a river am I, great nature sends me drifting, moves me, moves my inward parts with joy. Great, I'll read it again. Great sea, send me drifting. You become like a weed in the river. You move with the currents of nature. You are merged entirely with the natural forces. Weed in a river am I. Great nature sends me drifting, moves me, moves my inward parts with joy. The lands around my dwelling are more beautiful from the day when it is given me to see. When it is given me to see faces that I have never seen before, all is more beautiful, and life is thankfulness. These guests of mine make my house ground. The presence of guests create space and make the little igloo into a grand mansion. The idea of space here is completely non-visual. What is called proprioceptive, meaning visceral, using all the inward feelings and all the inward sensations, as well as hearing and movement and touch. This is the kind of space in this picture up on the screen. It is a space that is made by the thing as it merges with the being of the world. The idea of standing out separate from the world or having any separate existence is not possible in this kind of space any more than in the space up there. Of course, when we put it on this illuminated object up on the screen, it completely falsifies its nature, which is to exist in a dark cave unperceived by anybody. And so when you take it out of its cave and you illuminate it and put it up here, it is completely distorted and rendered into a completely new kind of space.
Gideon points out, as a matter of fact, in his book, Beginnings of Art, that he took the occasion once to duplicate what must have been a primitive lighting technique of some kind or another, probably animal fat in some kind of a reeds. And he took these in, and he said it was quite a frightening experience because of the flickering of the light across all these images with which he was surrounded. They'd come close to him and back away from him, so that the experience of those who did see these images must have been really quite a magical one.
You can see that when we electrically put our nervous system outside ourselves as an environment, then we too begin to feel once more this oneness with the forces of the world. It's as if we were living at the bottom of some vast sea. And we begin to feel the currents pushing us, merging us, in the same way that these preliterate people felt the pressures of environment as godlike. They assumed, naturally, that all these outer forces were gods. The word small g, the word God, is used for every technological invention in any primitive society. Any knife, any skin, any clothing, this is a god. And they thought of the entire being of nature, what we call nature, they just thought of as God. They didn't have a name for nature. But perhaps we might shift to a...
I was going to point out, actually, I didn't realize it until now. Actually, the drawing you're looking at is by Labbé Bruyère.
Well, that was one of his doctored up chiaroscuro jobs. Yes, you see, the cave paintings were never on any flat surface. The cave painters never dreamed of using any... If there was a flat place in the cave, they never used that for painting.
It's allied, actually, to what we now refer to as found objects. In fact, there's a whole theory of art that... The Eskimo, for example, will wander around until he finds a piece of stone that suggests something to him.
And then he releases the force... from the stone. He doesn't cut the stone to look like the object, but releases the object from the stone.
So that in the caves he would wander around looking at the surfaces until the crevices and the indentations in the rock began to suggest something to him, and then he would just amplify that with paint and sometimes with a little bit of carving in the stone. But they were there already.
Are you going to say something?
Well, the avoiding of flat surfaces, the characteristic of all the cave paintings is that wherever there's a flat surface, there's no painting. The flat surface, you see, is again visual, continuum, connected, plane. And to the non-visual, non-literate man, he prefers any form of rough, sculptured object to any flat thing, whatever. We're going to try our next
one. Next slide. Next slide, please. Yeah, this is a 12th century icon, and I'd like to point out some of the qualities of the icon. Now, this is a... We have to recognize that between the cave painting and this painting, there lay the whole business of the Greco-Roman world of realism, particularly in the Roman world of psychological portraiture, which became extremely lifelike in sculpture. But during the Middle Ages, of course, this tended to revert again. There are still some influences of Rome, of the realism. And in the next slide of an icon, I will show you in an Irish 7th century manuscript some of these indications of the Roman sense of perspective and so on. But one of the qualities of a painting of this kind, the icon, is a tremendous stress upon outline. The outlines are never lost. Another quality is that each object stands as an individual thing. In fact, in many of them, you will find that there is no overlapping at all. Here, there is a slight overlapping. Another is the tremendous insistence on overall patterning, which is highly tactile. And then again, no modeling from light to dark.
And no facial expression.
Yeah, no individuality, actually.
Very careful avoidance of any private expression in favor of the corporate mask, the deadpan. Because private expression, well, you know, it's as distasteful to a Chinese even now as he wears the mask of his whole group. He does not try to look like a private individual. And the idea of trying to look individual and private and separate comes with much literacy and is... There wasn't enough literacy around in the 12th century to make them want to look individual.
You'll notice that this image is also frontal parallel. There is no such a thing as foreshortening, limbs coming toward you, for example. The hands are drawn in action, which is very descriptive of the hand. I mean, there's no ambiguity at all in this rendering. Feet indicate some slight perspective, as a matter of fact, because they do look as if they're lying flat on the surface, whereas in earlier things, the foot will be down like this, straight down. But that's a legacy from Rome.
The ritual, after all, these people are wearing ritual costumes. The ritual always calls for the iconic, the strong outline or contour.
I'd like also to point out that there are no bodies underneath these clothes. There's a face up there, and then down at the bottom there's some feet, but there doesn't seem to be any skeletal structure linking them. They exist just as costume. Yes.